Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we get started, please join me in a brief prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I am grateful to be joined today by Dr. Carl Richard, Professor of History at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Professor Richard received his PhD in history from Vanderbilt University. His research interests include intellectual history, American history, and the history of ancient Greece and Rome. But listen to this list of just some of his books, and I think any Ciceronian Society regular will immediately recognize why he's on this show. His books include The Founders and the Classics, Greece, Rome, and the American Enlightenment, Harvard Press, 1994, 12 Greeks and Romans Who Changed the World, Roman and Littlefield, 2003. The Battle for the American Mind, A Brief History of a Nation's Thought, Roman and Littlefield, 2004. Greeks and Romans, Bearing Gifts, How the Ancients Inspired the Founding Fathers, that's 2008. Golden Age of the Classics in America, Greece, Rome, and the Antebellum United States, Harvard, 2009. Why We're All Romans, The Roman Contribution to the Western World, 2010. When the United States Invaded Russia, that's kind of the oddball here, Woodrow Wilson's Siberian Disaster, published in 2013. And then The Founders in the Bible, published back in 2016. And he has also contributed a host of essays to edited volumes, including two books published by Oxford University Press. We'll hit a few of these subjects before concluding with his most recent book, So Help Us God, American Presidents and the Bible, published by Roman and Littlefield, 2025. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with an admission, as I've said privately. You've been writing for decades, and I'm only now discovering your work and wondering what I've been doing with my life. Because, I mean, had I known this was something historians did, had I read your work, I probably would have gone this direction in my research, I think. You're essentially celebrating America's classical and Christian inheritance and reminding us what we owe the Greeks, the Romans, and the Bible especially. So before we get to your newest book, I'd love for you just to reflect here on the why behind that particular body of scholarship. What inspired you to take up America's classical and Christian inheritance?
Well, I've always, since I was young, had an interest in Greece and Rome. And my original intention was to get a PhD in ancient history. However, I discovered I just didn't have the languages, plural, for that. I had the Greek and I had the French for secondary sources, but I didn't have the Latin or the German. Mm-hmm. You need all four of those to begin actually doing serious classical scholarship. And I was very impatient. And so I said, well, what else am I interested in? Well, I was interested in the American Revolution and the Founding Fathers. And so it was actually my mentor at Vanderbilt, Paul Calkin, who said, well, why don't you combine those two? Why don't you do some research on the influence of Greece and Rome on the Founding Fathers? And I said, I could do that? And he said, yes. So that's how I got involved in that subject.
Excellent. Now, in one of your earlier books called The Golden Age of Classics in America, you argue that this golden age was actually, and I thought this was one of the more surprising things I saw, was actually the antebellum period. Because I was, you know, going into your body of work, I'm thinking, okay, the golden age is probably the founding period, right? This is the moment of Madison and Adams and Jefferson. They certainly a classicist in their own right. But you call the golden age is antebellum America, which struck me as counterintuitive. I'm just wondering, and I know it's been a while since that book was published, in a very general sense, what are some of the things that you found in writing that volume, and what did you argue for in that volume?
Well, I call it the Golden Age because, I mean, certainly the classics played an enormous role in the founding of the country. But at that time, it was largely something that the elites did, something that the elites were interested in. But what I found in the antebellum period is all of that got diffused into society. And so an unprecedented percentage, I guess you'd see, of the population were now interested in the classics and pursuing the classics. Still a minority going to college, of course, but it you begin to get lots of translations, you know, not only Plutarch but other classical authors and newspapers, magazines, all writing or trying to popularize the classics. You also had a movement within the universities of going beyond what had been mostly Rome, mostly Latin, and expanding it to include the dramatists, the Athenian dramatists, increasing the Greek section of Greek and Latin. And so it was being, classics are being expanded in so many ways in terms of the percentage of the population. You know, you begin to have female colleges, which didn't exist in the time of the founders, teaching women for the first time, really the classics. So just a broadening of that influence beyond just the elites to the rest of society. And of course, as the country is growing, territorially, people are moving west. You get a whole bunch of new universities, all of whom are teaching the classics. So I think it was the golden age in that sense that never before and never since has so much of the population been familiar in one way or another with the classics, whether it was firsthand through reading Greek and Latin or more likely through translation. And that declines, you know, in the late 19th century. You begin to get this movement to diversify the education. It's no longer, you know, at Harvard and Yale by the end of the century, it was no longer required of students to take the classics and so on. So I really think that antebellum period was the golden age in the sense of the breadth of exposure of the classics.
Why do you think to late 19th century? Because I mean, it's not controversial, and I don't think, to say that Americans from all walks of life, including the allegedly educated and among our elites, they've completely forgotten this inheritance, right? It's seldom discussed, doesn't really come up. I mean, I have to explain who Cicero is on a regular basis, or we get someone who says is, they'll call us the Caesarian Society. That's the one I get the most often. Very different organization. I'd like to go a little bit more into what happened. I mean, historically speaking, yes, they're diversifying the curriculum and kind of the progressive movement of education in the late 19th century. I'm curious what you found to be, and I know this wasn't directly in there, but what was their argument against continuing the classics? I mean, the classics didn't go away completely, but you're right. I mean, they, in terms of in the curriculum and in terms of requirements, they there's a dramatic shift at the turn of the 19th and 20th century. What was their, for lack of a better word, beef with the classics? Why abandon them at all?
Well, what I find interesting, it seems to have been a result of utilitarianism, and you know those arguments had gone back centuries, you know, and in every generation you had people saying, well, it's just not useful. The classics are not useful. They're outdated, and we need to be studying science, or we need to be studying other languages, or there's something else that's more important that we need to be studying. That had always been the case. There were always those people, but they were always defeated. And in the late 19th, early 20th century, they succeeded for the first time. But you're pretty much using the same utilitarian argument that this is that the classics are somehow outdated, not really useful, that we should be studying something else. And why that happened at that time, I don't know. It was the period of the Industrial Revolution. It was the period in which science, you begin to get Darwinism, you begin to science becomes more in vogue. And it seems to me that that's what happened, that the utilitarians finally won. And it's debatable as to why they finally won, but it really seemed to be a very kind of materialistic age, practical age, and I use that term in a narrow sense because I think the classics are very practical,
Of course.
but a very narrow definition of what is practical, I guess, prevailed at that time.
I wonder if there's something I hadn't thought about this before, but in that time of kind of just this excitement of scientific change and explanation, and that they it seems like the world is less mysterious, less enchanted, right? For lack of a better word. And so in some ways it's the sciences are more attractive to a world of people who think, well, we know it all now, and we can control whatever, whether it's engineering society or a state or the natural world. There's this sense of, why would I need these outdated people who lived it with, superstitions and religion and stories and imagination? Now we have science. We don't need this anymore, right? I mean, I think there's, just going back to your argument, I think that utilitarian piece is there. I think it'd be interesting to dig deeper in that. And I encourage our listeners, if you that'd be an interesting paper for the Ciceronian Society. Why did this happen? I think it's easy to say, well, the progressives just didn't like it, and so they got to, well, but they probably had some arguments, and what were those arguments, and why were they as, why were they wrong?
And there
If
is,
you
I do want to say there is an argument, which is interesting, that that perhaps one of the problems was that the defenders of the classics were arguing on the wrong ground. That is, they adopted too much utilitarianism themselves, and so they were defending the classics in kind of a strange way, that it is utilitarian in the sense that things like, well, knowing Greek and Latin will improve your English. Well, there is some truth to that, but it's very indirect form of argumentation. I mean, surely there are other ways of improving your English. So if you get down on the utilitarian battleground and fight them on their own very narrow grounds as to what is immediately materially useful, rather than a broader definition, which I think the founders had, of utility, of what is useful, then I think you're in losing territory.
That's interesting. And I think that gets to a lot of in terms of strategy, not only for the Ciceronian society saying, why do we exist? Why do we do what we do? This is also true of, we have a large audience of classical educators in classical schools. And I think they're wrestling with this as well. And where is a classical education valuable because of job prospects later on, or because you can achieve, you can earn this much money? We're back in the same ground, right? Then we're back on the same battleground. What do you think? So we've acknowledged that interest and knowledge of the classics declines, and as well as I, and this gets to, your later work, knowledge of the Bible has been declining. But with the classics in particular, what do you think the implications have been? Kind of the unintended consequences of forgetting the Greeks and the Romans in particular, over time here.
Well, it's just a very rich body of literature that deals with the human condition, and that's what makes them classics. They transcend their time. They deal with universal human problems and universal human emotions, and in a very rich and thoughtful way. And so I think it's really disturbing today. I think the kind of simplistic grounds on which we think about things and argue about things, I guess it's intellectual equipment, and
Yeah.
if your equipment is very shallow, then you're not going to think in very complex terms. You're not going to I think you're not going to be very successful in the decisions that you do make if they're based on very shallow grounds.
Well, I also think too that the classics help us develop character. And I used to be a professor, and the students were always like, okay, how does this class help me get this job or earn this money? Well, look, so many of the jobs you think that you're going to work, first of all, it may not happen, but also they don't exist yet. And so how you thrive in a marketplace, and again, I don't want to go back to their battleground. I think the classics are valuable in their own right, regardless of materialistic or instrumental arguments. But there is something to be said about the formative, the moral and spiritual and imaginative formation that happens when you encounter the classics that prepares you for any life, right? Whether in feast or famine, poverty or wealth, whatever it happens to be, it's slave or free, right? I mean, that was certainly the story of the 19th century, thinking of the influence the classics had on people like Frederick Douglass, couldn't think of his name, but also the elites, right? I think that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the question of ethics because I think that's central. Ethics are a very practical subject. I mean, this is something we have to deal with every day, is what is right and what is wrong. And we live in a very relativistic age. And but I think it's really, I've always felt that moral relativism really is very problematic, because I think in reality there are no moral relativists, because we all have to make these decisions, and we each have a pretty clear idea of the basis for those decisions, even if we may not think about them or express them. They're there, and the way that I often put it is that no one is a moral relativist when he has been wronged. We
Right.
all know when we've been wronged, and we say that's wrong. It's only when we ourselves are accused of doing wrong that we become a moral relativist. And I think this is true. I mean, I've never met a moral relativist who really was a moral relativist. Because if someone did something that was wrong to that person, they immediately say that's wrong. And so I just think moral relativism is very shallow, but it's very common today, extremely common. I think that's very unfortunate for our society, and it creates all kinds of problems, practical problems, but also intellectual problems, because if you can't discuss, what is right and what is wrong, then you're in a very bad state, I think.
Or if you can't get to a point where, anyone wants to give an answer in this respect, like you can discuss what's right and wrong, but no one wants to make a decision. I had a class once that still haunts me, where I said, look, can we objectively say that I, Dr. Josh Bowman, am morally inferior in some ways, or at least in terms of character, I am inferior to Mother Teresa? Which I think is objectively true. And they were like, well, no, I mean, there might be a different world or a different scenario in which Mother Teresa is worse than you. And I'm like, there is no such thing as a world in which Mother Teresa is worse than me. She's just not. Even from a Christian standpoint, we may be equal in the eyes of God, which is astonishing to me. But at the same time, it's just like, no, she's a better human being than I will ever be.
And the classics in general were a body of moral literature, and most of the authors are very clear about that, that they were very much concerned with issues of right and wrong. And maybe that's another reason why they went into decline, the rise of moral relativism.
When you do you still get to teach courses on classical history, Roman and Greek history?
I do because I'm at a university that does not have a classics department, and I've benefited from that from because my PhD is in American intellectual history, not in ancient history. So if we had a classics department, I wouldn't get to teach those courses, but since we don't, I do, and I enjoy them, and the students seem to enjoy them. There's a lot of interest in Greece and Rome. Anytime I teach one of those courses, it's always full.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? I mean, I know why I love it, but it seems to be counterintuitive, right? If we told our colleagues, like, yeah, I bet if I offer this course on Cicero, I'm going to fill it up, right? You'd be right. I think that would happen. But why? I mean, why now has it been like that? What have you seen in your experience with that?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, some of it is popular entertainment. They've seen Gladiator, or they've seen the 300, or that's some of it. But I also think that that they know that this civilization, Western civilization, was begun by the Greeks and Romans. And so there is a sense, I think, that they know, well, I should know more about this, because it isn't taught as much as it should be. So I think that's part of it. Now why the question of why they enroll in the classes is interesting, and I'm not sure I fully know the reason. But I think I do know the reason why, when they do enroll, they become very fascinated. And I think it's for the same reason that I've been fascinated by the classics for so long. And that is that the strange combination of familiarity and peculiarity. On the one hand, I mean, they did found our civilization, and so they have a lot of values in common with us. But on the other hand, it was a pagan culture. And there were a lot of things that, the mythology especially, but other attitudes, practices, and so on, that just seemed very bizarre to us, because we live, even those who are not Christians anymore, live in a society that was formed by Christianity. And so I think, I know in my case, and I think in their case too, this co strange combination. On the one hand, what these people are writing seems very familiar to me, but on the other hand, it seems very bizarre. Certain aspects seem very bizarre. And this happens even to me, after having studied for many years. I remember reading a passage in Columella, who wrote a first century Roman, wrote an agricultural manual, very good agricultural manual, actually. And so I'm reading Columella, and he's got all this very rational advice. You might, you begin to think of him as though he's a 21st century person, because he's so rational and logical and scientific in his approach. And all of a sudden, I come to a paragraph in which he states that if you have a cow that is suffering from an intestinal ailment, show the cow a waterfowl, like a duck or something, and this
Okay.
will instantly cure the cow of the intestinal ailment. And I stopped with my mouth open and said, "What?" But he was not a 21st century scientist. He was a first century Roman, and there was no dichotomy in his mind between what we would call scientific and these other principles that were just sort of folk wisdom. He didn't see any contradiction in that. And then, of course, it leads to all kinds of fast. I had to put the book down, because it led to fascinating speculations in my mind I wanted to know who first came up with this idea that you could cure a cow of intestinal ailment by showing him a duck or her a duck. You just wonder where these things came from. But that's what I mean by a combination of familiarity and peculiarity. Some things are so familiar they could be written today, but then other things are so bizarre that, and it and then reminds you, hey, these people lived in a very different culture than we do today. And I find that fascinating that they could be so much the same and so different from us. And
Well, next time.
I think my students find that interesting too.
Well, next time my kids have the stomach flu, I'm just going to bring them a duck. You don't need that medicine. I got some fowl for you. Before we leave the classics behind, kind of, we are the Ciceronian Society. We're not a Cicero Studies organization, but we certainly encourage it very strongly. And I'm just wondering, over the course of several of those books, Cicero shows up on a number of occasions. How would you describe, in a very general sense? I know you can't get in too specific, but what did you experience as his particular role, in the American founding, that antebellum period? How would you describe his character, if you will, a dramatis personae in that world of classics in the American founding?
I think he was probably the most influential of all the ancients, of all the classical. I'm not leaving aside the biblical, but the classical authors. And I think it makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the founders were politicians, right? They were orators, they were statesmen. And, who was the great model of oratory? It was Cicero. Who was the great statesman? Cicero. They were Republicans, small R Republicans, and he was a martyr, Republican martyr. And then he's just a great writer too, and they read his works. I mentioned earlier, I think, that in their age, we talk about Greek and Latin, but it was really primarily Latin. They just got a smattering of Greek. And so he was a staple of their educational system. And I don't mean college. It really starts in the grammar school. They're reading Cicero in the grammar school. So this is someone whose work they read. They read his orations against Catiline and other orations in school, letters, and so on. And so they were very familiar with his work, and then of course they knew the story of his martyrdom on behalf of republicanism. So all of that made him I think, a profoundly influential figure for all of the founders, but I think especially for John Adams. Adams, from the time he was young, followed Cicero as his great idol. And he'll write in his diary that he exults in the fact that law is his chosen profession because it was the profession of Cicero. And he one time he has an argument with his parents, a heated argument, and he goes to his room and he picks up Cicero and starts declaiming his one of his speeches out loud because it made him feel better. Just the sounds, he said, the rhythm and all of that of his orations made him feel better. And when people forget sometimes because there were no recording devices, the people who became most famous were people like Jefferson, who wrote well. The leading orators, we don't have recordings of their speeches. And therefore, they didn't acquire the same fame in many cases. And so people forget that Adams was the leading orator in Congress for independence. And it was he who got up on July 1st, 1776, and gave the final big speech that led to the Independence Resolution the following day. And in his diary, he wrote that he started his speech by saying, "This is the first time," which I don't think was true, but "it's the first time in my life that I've ever really envied Cicero, because he never spoke on any subject that was more important than the one I'm speaking on today. And I wish I had his eloquence," basically. And then for the rest of his life, when things turned sour, he lost a re-election campaign, really because he had the integrity of a Cicero. He made peace with France, which was not popular in his own party. People like Hamilton wanted to go to war with France, even though it was best for the country to be at peace. And so he basically sacrificed his re-election for the sake of the country, divided his own party. And then in retirement, looking back on what he considered to be a failed political career, he thought of Cicero, and he comforted himself by saying, "Well, Cicero was despised by all the parties," as he called them, the factions of Rome, just like I am, because he was virtuous just like I am. And so that gave him consolation to think that he was still another Cicero, and that, yes, there were costs to this, costs of in popularity and so on. But he was okay with that because, his idol Cicero had suffered the same sort of unpopularity that he was suffering.
The idea of Cicero as a kind of therapy is entertaining to me. And next time I have a stressful day, I'm just going to come home and read a Philippic and just see what happened.
Well,
That'd be great.
you have to read it out loud, because he said the sound of it, just the majestic sound of it, made him feel good.
That's great. Now, moving from that to more recent scholarship, you've been focusing on the Bible and the impact of the Bible on the American founding and presidents. And so, an important precursor to this brand new book on the presidents was your 2016 volume, The Founders and the Bible. What was your goal in that particular book? And am I right in assuming your work in that one led to this more recent one?
Yes, it did. Well, I have to say, this was one book. This doesn't always happen. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But this was definitely one book where what I learned in the research surprised me. Because I had always been taught and had never really examined the subject for myself. I'd always been taught by my professors that the founders were all deists. And the ones that I had come across, that wasn't what I was studying. I was studying their classical influence, but the ones that I had come across tended to be, I wouldn't say deist, but I would say biblically unorthodox. And so that kind of led me to believe, okay, well, what I was taught was true. Most of them were biblically unorthodox. And that's not what I discovered at all. I studied about 30 major founders, and I found that only four of them were what I call biblically unorthodox. And then there were another few that you really couldn't tell. They didn't leave enough evidence to decide. And then 23, I think, out of 30 were what I would call biblically orthodox. So that was a surprising find to me.
And so, with this new book, then, So Help Us God, American Presidents in the Bible, each chapter seems to center on a given theme for which the Bible played some part in the lives and administrations of presidents from George Washington through to today. I have a question. This kind of gets to both these recent books, The Founders in the Bible, and then Presidents, the American Presidents in the Bible. What was your methodological strategy here? Because I found myself asking this because it's one thing to find presidents quoting the Bible, especially in the early days, right? In the first 150 years, rhetorically, it's a good idea. But to determine whether or not they, the speaker, are taking it seriously, or at least historically, what are you trying to show here? Because I found myself saying, like, do they really mean that? It's just because I mean, there's certainly some presidents in particular where I just do not necessarily have a very, shall we say, rosy opinion of. But others I certainly did. And so why in approaching that methodologically, how do you determine influence or importance where they've used the Bible, but it was but they were sincere? Like, how did you navigate that challenge?
Well, it's always a challenge. I think one way of determining that, are they in their private writings, diaries, letters, private communications, are they saying the same things? And in most cases, they were saying the same things. So yes, sure. And I deal with that in both of the last two books, the fact that there was some rhetorical utility as a politician in quoting from the Bible. There's no question about that. But the same was true of the classics, by the way. I mean, there were some, and it was different. The interesting thing to me is different utility with the classics. When you cite the classics, what you're trying to say is I'm highly educated, and you're appealing really to you generally to an aristocratic audience. Whereas when you cite the Bible, you're saying I am pious, I am virtuous, and those references are aimed at the general population, because the general population throughout our history has had, well, until recently, I would guess, but for most of our history, the general population has had very strong familiarity with the Bible, much more than with the Greco-Roman classics. So it's interesting to me that it was useful. Both the classics and the Bible were useful to quote as a politician. But they were useful in the sense of appealing to different audiences many times, and achieving different goals. But yeah, there's no question that there was an element of utility in citing the Bible, just as there was for the classics. But when you find in diaries, when you have private letters, private communications, that the person is saying basically the same thing, then it seems to me logical to conclude that the person was being sincere in their public pronouncements.
In doing that, then, like in the different, I don't know how much, exactly. I mean, you work through mostly the stuff that's accessible, public papers, private diaries, public addresses, different things like that. What were some things that surprised you? Were there certain presidents that you expected to be less or more biblical, not necessarily in the Orthodox or unorthodox sense, although that's part of it, but also that they would give it more attention? Was there one or more presidents that you thought, wow, they really did think about this, or they read it more than I thought they did, or they didn't read it as much as I thought they did? Did you find any of that?
That's a good question. Offhand, I'm not thinking of anything. What really surprised me most, I think, was how many of these biblical themes that I had found in the founders in the Bible continued throughout almost all, if not all, of American history, well into the 20th century, even into the late 20th century. So that really surprised me, the fact that there were certain themes. For instance, providence, the belief in divine intervention, that's one thing I say in the founders in the Bible is I don't believe that, contrary to what I was taught, I don't believe that any of the founders were deists, because deism, one of the definitions of it is the belief that God does not intervene in the world. And I found that even the most unorthodox, Jefferson, Thomas Paine, they all argued that God intervened in the world. And not just in general, the American Revolution, for instance, which they all believe God was behind that, but in personal terms. I mean, Thomas Paine, who was probably the most radical of all of them, he wrote a book attacking the Bible, The Age of Reason. Even Thomas Paine claims that the reason he survived the French Revolution was that God protected him. So they all believe that, and it continues all the way up until fairly current times, that you find presidents speaking and even using that word, providence. And both in a personal sense, in terms of, for instance, those who were veterans claiming that God protected them in battle, and that's why they weren't killed in battle. Harry Truman, for instance, was an artillery captain in World War I, and claimed that God protected him, or he would have died on the battlefield. In terms of introducing their spouses into their lives, and then, of course, in a national sense, that is one of the most persistent themes of all, which is that God is behind the United States, that the United States is a new Israel, a nation that has kind of a covenant with God, and that God has always protected and always blessed the country in a unique way, to a unique degree. In fact, one of the chapters of the new book is called Israel's, and then colon, Old, New, and Restored. And it's kind of interesting to me that from the beginning, from Washington on, there's this sense that the United States is the new Israel. The old Israel had gone out of existence. The United States is the new Israel, and then something interesting happens. The old Israel, the biblical Israel, is restored in 1948. And by the way, Harry Truman was instrumental in that. 11 minutes after Israel was born, on May 14th, 1948. By the way, May 14th is an interesting date because it's also the day that Jamestown was formed, the first English colony, 1607. Anyway, 11 minutes after Israel was formed, the United States recognized Israel, and that was Truman's insistence. The State Department said, "We can't do it. We need the oil from the Arabs, and we can't antagonize them." And because of his strong, biblical beliefs, he said, "We have to support Israel. This is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy." And there's a story that one of the leading rabbis met with Truman and told him, "You're the God placed you in your mother's womb for this very reason," and that Truman broke down and wept. So we get a restored Israel, which then the United States supports. And but we're still, even with this, even with Israel coming back into existence, we continue to believe that the United States is also an Israel. And so we sort of have two Israels, two nations that are covenanted with God. But I just found that very interesting, the fact that you have this very strong theme at the very beginning with Washington. And I did not expect such themes to carry through all the way into current times, but some of them really have.
Yeah, I was also surprised. I didn't think that the Israel motif went back as far as it did. I thought it was much more recent. Or at least like late 19th century, thinking of dispensationalism, the connection there. There's so many great, themes in here between the different chapters. You've talked about providence, you talked about the chapter on Israel. Maybe mention the chapter on prayer. I'm curious, you write, "An inevitable result of the president's belief in a caring, intervening God of infinite power has been their confidence in the efficacy of prayer. In turn, this confidence has led them to call for both public and private prayer." Something, when was the last time we heard that? What did you find in that chapter, that this kind of belief in prayer and how they thought through how that showed up in their presidencies?
Well, it's another thing that is surprising sometimes. Francis Jefferson loved to pray. And you think of him, he was one of the least orthodox of the founders, one of the most biblically unorthodox of the founders. But that was something that he really, and I think maybe carried over from childhood. He had an older sister, Jane, I believe her name was, that he was very close to. And I think he prayed with her, and she taught him the Psalms. He always loved the Psalms. And people think of Jefferson's unorthodoxy, and they assumed then that he was a 21st century secularist. And that just isn't true. I mean, he was a product of his time, which is the late 18th century. And so he often would close letters by promising to pray for the person that he was writing to. And that was not something that was necessarily expected. That was just something that he did. He also liked to go to church services. It's something he enjoyed doing. And so those kinds of things are a bit surprising. So he liked to pray, and there were others, Lincoln, of course, in the midst of this terrible Civil War, found great comfort in prayer. Of course, again, it's always hard to separate the utility from the belief, because, of course, it was expected through most of our history, when there was a time of crisis, that the president would call for a day of fasting and prayer. And that was expected, and there was a political element to that, of course. But you find presidents in private referring, I think, quite sincerely to prayer, the power of prayer. And especially I found those presidents who became president unexpectedly due to the death of their predecessor. They weren't expecting to be president, and now they have this awesome responsibility thrust upon them. I mean, Truman, I hate to keep going back to Truman, but he's such a colorful person. When Franklin Roosevelt died unexpectedly, with World War II still going on, Truman told the reporters, who I don't think were necessarily the most pious people, but he said, "Pray for me, boys." He said, "I feel like a bale of hay has fallen on me." And that must be how they all felt if they suddenly became president without expecting to be president. And so many of them speak about that, about how their natural reaction then was to look up, to God, saying, "Please, I need help,
Certainly relatable.
By the way, one thing I would recommend, if you go to the Franklin Roosevelt Library, Presidential Library site, one of the things you can find there is the famous prayer that he gave via radio on D-Day. And I have a long quote from that in the book. It's a beautiful prayer that Roosevelt recited over the airwaves and on D-Day. And this was not, in hindsight, we look at it and say, "Oh, it was successful." Nobody knew whether that was going to be successful or not. So I think he was quite sincere in calling upon Almighty God for help, in his crusade against oppression and evil. The Nazis were evil. And I think he was very sincere in that. And it's a beautiful prayer. And there's something else too. At that time, people said, "Well, why don't you do what all your predecessors have done, which is to call for a national day of prayer and fasting?" And Roosevelt said, "This is too big a crisis for that. It's an existential crisis." And so what he urged Americans to do was pray every day. When you get up in the morning, when you go to bed at night, pray. This goes beyond one day set aside, one designated day of prayer. You should be in continuous prayer.
Which of course is also a very Christian thing, right?
Yeah.
1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray continually.
Right.
Not just when it's convenient. There's a lot more you could go here. I wanted to go to your epilogue, though. You write here in the epilogue. Since the 1960s, however, American culture has been transformed to such an extent that various observers, both Christian and secularist, have plausibly labeled it post-Christian. Even many self-professed Christians now possess only a vague familiarity with the contents of the Bible and have come to reject its teachings concerning sexuality and other subjects. I would agree with that, certainly. And then you write, what the future holds for the nation when the presidency is held by generations that have not been raised on scriptural verities. What texts will be hailed as authorities and what unifying themes will be presented remains to be seen. Now, I know, you're a historian, speculation is dangerous. But I mean, we've seen, and this is in many ways motivates what we as a Ciceronian society are driven by, this kind of widespread departure from our what the memory of Western civilization, not only the classics, but of course the Bible, even among Christians. Biblical illiteracy is this massive thing. Predicting the future is a dangerous thing. But I mean, what have you seen that concerns you? Because I mean, there does seem to be a feeling in this book that you're writing about something we've lost or that we are losing. Is that part of the story here?
I think it is. I think it is. I suppose it should be full disclosure. I myself am a Christian, and so naturally, I approach this subject from that standpoint. And I don't think you have enough time if you want to talk about the things that concern me. But in general, that's probably the overarching thing is the loss of biblical literacy. And I would say most concerning among Christians, among self-professed Christians. I think that is probably the greatest problem that we confront today. Because if you don't know what's in if you don't know what's in the Bible, how can you defend it? Again, we're in an age of moral relativism, which doesn't seem to be to me rational, and it doesn't seem to me to be healthy.
Very, very rootless, right? I mean, not only in terms of geographical, we move. We're a lot more transient. We as Americans, we move around a lot. I know I have, and the fight to stay in one place has been a thing for us. But we're also, when you don't have that biblical knowledge as a Christian, the temptation, the vulnerability being swayed or moved or to despair or to ideology, I think it's just so much greater. It certainly has been for me. I mean, when times when I have been not in the word, it has been to my detriment. And so I think there's a lot to that. I also think too, I mean, just not being in the classics, I one of the I there was a time in my life where, and I wish I could follow up with this at some point with him, but there was a pastor. He was a Church of God. I'm Anglican ACNA today, but I was at one point part of the Church of God, based in Tennessee. And my pastor, I was job shadowing him because I thought I was going to be a pastor. And then I said to him, "What, in terms of your preparation for ministry, what's one thing you regret not doing?" And I'll never forget, he said, "I wish I would have read more literature." Now, he didn't say classical literature, but I know, and with later interaction, I know that's what he meant. I never got to ask him why that was. But I think there's also a sense in which there's not only is there a biblical illiteracy, there's also a kind of cultural and historical illiteracy that is detrimental to our witness as Christians. And to our survival, right? In some ways, in this particular moment, right?
I mean, we're going back to what we talked about earlier, which is I would call it intellectual equipment. And if you don't have intellectual equipment, then what are you going to base your decisions on? It seems you're likely to base your decisions on whatever is currently fashionable. And yeah, I mean, I think there is a common link there. the decline of the classics and the decline of the Bible. And that is this sort of belief that you just kind of make it up as you go along, that whatever's popular, that there is no real, we talk about relativism. It goes beyond even that, that there is no real truth.
Right.
That truth itself is relative, not just moral truth, but truth in general. And therefore, why spend a lot of time reading ancient
Anything.
literature, whether it's classical or biblical?
Yeah.
You don't need to do that. Just look around you and see what other people are doing and do and saying and do the same thing.
Right. Ends up being the will of the stronger. I mean, there is it, it, what's interesting to me is that battle, or that struggle against relativism, is very old, of course, as we know. It's as old as Plato. We know that, right? In the sense that there have always been people who are, denying truth, or at least, or denying God in different ways. And so, we would do well to read not only scripture and the classics as they kind of fight this fight in a way. The Church Fathers are another example, and other figures in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, Reformation, all this these periods are fruitful. I want to close with this question. So the subject of our classical and Christian inheritance for America in particular, and especially looking to 2026, I never get the word right. Semi-sesquicentennial? Is that the right word? I don't know. Whatever it is, 250th. But that Christian inheritance for America and the Western world generally, it's a subject near and dear to us. And we want to encourage research in this area. So what opportunities do you think remain for digging deeper? If you were in, trying going to inspire new projects for new, future PhD students or current scholars that are writing in this area, what do you think remains to be uncovered or looked into?
You're referring to the classics,
Yeah, well,
classical.
I'm saying this broadly. I mean, thinking about your work in general, you've and I should well, maybe not pioneered, but you've covered so much ground with the classical and Christian inheritance and how what we thought, we've forgotten our inheritance, what we thought was its impact, right? You mentioned how we were taught, I was taught, right, that they were all deists, for example. I'm just wondering, is there more work to be done here, both in terms of the classical influence on America and America's history and development, as well as the biblical development?
Yeah, I think there is more work to be done because both of those traditions were just so influential in the course of our history. I think one of the big obstacles to that is the lack of knowledge of the classics and the Bible. That is, I think one of the reasons why I think these subjects have been neglected is because most scholars don't know those bodies of literature. And so if they come across, if they're reading the papers of the founding fathers and they come across references to ancient Greeks or Romans or to biblical figures, and it's pardon the expression, it's like Greek to them, that they don't know who these people are that the founders are talking about. The natural inclination, the natural human inclination when you come across something that's unfamiliar is to dismiss it, to say, well, that's not important. Let me just skim over this and get to the important stuff. And so I think the first thing that has to happen is you have to have scholars who are familiar, highly familiar with these ancient bodies of literature so that they're well equipped when they come across these references to know what is being referred to, and then look at the context in which it's being referred, and then to be able to explain to your readers who may not have that familiarity, what communication is occurring. Because it really is almost like a foreign language. And I have to say, when I was starting out, when I was a graduate student and first started out working on the founders and the classics, I didn't know the classics as well as I should have. And there are many cases where I would go to my classics professors and say things like, who the heck was Helvidius Priscus? Because Madison uses Helvidius as a pseudonym. And in the founders' days, they often used these classical pseudonyms. And they often chose people that were, we would say, somewhat obscure, just to show how familiar they were with the classics. But oftentimes, their selection of that pseudonym was very important to the argument they were trying to make in the essay. And so I was constantly having to go to these classics professors at Vanderbilt, my classics professors, and saying, "Who was Helvidius Priscus?" And then they would calmly explain to me who the person was and where I could find, where the founder probably found that information. And that was crucial. And if I had not been studying that subject, my inclination probably would have been to say, "Well, who cares? Let's just move on. That's not important." We tend to dismiss as unimportant things that we don't understand. And so I think there's a lot that can be done, a lot more scholarship that can be done, but it requires people who are familiar with those texts.
Yeah, I think of the one example where Hamilton uses the name of Cicero, right, for the Whiskey Rebellion. I have a hard time. I mean, maybe I don't understand all of it, but is it really as big of a threat as Catiline was to Rome? I don't know.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of exaggeration going on. But there are politicians,
Well, of course,
We
especially Hamilton.
forget that. I mean, we tend to idolize them because they really were great men and they really accomplished some incredible things. But they were still human beings and politicians, and they used rhetoric and often exaggerated the dangers from the other party, much as we do today. But in a sense, that's encouraging because it tells us, okay, they were human just like we are. And so we shouldn't despair that, oh, we could never equal them, and we could never, if it came to it, we couldn't save our country the way they did. No, I mean, they were human beings, and yet they were great men, flawed but great men. And by the way, that's actually my next book that I'm finishing right now. It's going to be a fun book. It's called The Heroism of the Founders, and the subtitle is How the American Founders Overcame Their Vices to Build a Nation. So I'm going to go deeply into their personal vices, but at the same time, I'm also going to go deeply into their accomplishments. And my whole major point is that they were men. They were men. They were flawed men, but they were also heroes. Because my definition of a hero is not a perfect person. My definition of a hero is one who overcomes his imperfections to accomplish great deeds. And that's why I consider the founders heroes.
Well, we'll have you on for that one. That's a great topic right there. Well, Dr. Richard, thank you so much. This has been such an encouraging conversation. I'm so glad you could join us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. And folks, I really encourage you to look up Karl Richard's books wherever you shop for books. This is very much someone you want to know, whose work you want to know. If you're like me, you'll start reading his books and start making a reading list to go afterwards, because there are lots of classics that he has read that I have never even heard of. And so I just was really encouraged by this, and I'm so glad that we got to do this. All right. Well, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. If you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Paper and panel proposals, which we certainly encourage you on any of these topics, the classics, the Christian tradition and its impact on America, those are due September 1st, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.